I'm Joanne Wilson, and this is Positively Gotham Gal. Real, honest, and meaningful conversations with women entrepreneurs about their approach to life, business, and everything in between.
Jing Gao is the founder of Fly by Jing, a line of Chinese spice and condiments inspired by her hometown of Zhengzhou. We got together over Zoom to discuss her entrepreneurial journey and the challenges of creating a high-quality, modern, female-led Chinese food brand.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Where are you locked? Where are you locked and loaded?
I'm in LA. I just moved to a new spot, so everything's very bare.
Where in LA are you?
I'm in Silver Lake.
Oh, okay. I'm on the other side of town right now. I'm in Venice.
Oh, okay. Nice. Are you normally in LA?
No, I usually am here in winter.
Okay.
Actually, my friends just drove down there to pick up bagels for me for the flight home tomorrow.
Oh, did you go at Courage?
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm excited. I mean, it's kind of funny I'm bringing bagels back to New York, but that's okay. All right. So we're going to get into it.
Yes.
You ready?
I'm ready.
All right. So, you know, I've always had a tremendous place in my heart for people that start CPG products because I think it is the hardest business ever to start. And there was a point when I would talk to any woman that would pretty much contact me about their CPG business because I knew the reality of the fundraising. And I watched all your videos and heard what you had to say. And it was interesting that they took you into the TechStars program because at the end of the day, I'm quite convinced that venture capital does not understand food and never will understand food, and it doesn't belong in their purview. It belongs in the private equity purview. But the question is, how do you fund something in the middle?
Mm-hmm.
You obviously learned all about. And, you know, you grew up in China, but then you also moved around a lot as a kid. And can you talk about how that made such an impact on who you are today?
Yeah, I mean, it had everything to do with who I am today and what I've chosen to do. I was born in Chengdu, so that's the food capital of China. Of course, when I was growing up, I didn't know that. And I was never, you know, super into food or anything. But my father was a nuclear physicist. And with his job, we moved around a lot to different universities in different countries every year, pretty much, until I was almost in high school. And at the time, that was just the norm. And so I thought it was normal to always feel like you never really quite belonged anywhere and to try to, you know, blend in, code switch, fit in. And I was able to do so. I think I'm, you know, naturally introverted, so I kept to myself a lot, but also, you know, I adopted this name, Jenny, to make it more, you know, palatable or easy for all the kids I was growing up with to call me, right? Because my full name is Jing Xuan Gao, which is a mouthful. And
China.
Yeah. So my dad was a nuclear physicist and he, you know, studied string theory. So he named me after string theory. My middle name is string, but it's a homonym for string, but it actually means dark and profound matter, which is a total like metaphysical thing. But anyway, so I decided to adapt to my environment by calling myself Jenny, and that name kind of stuck for the next 30 years. And I didn't realize how much that had impacted me and the way I viewed myself, you know, as a person, or, you know, in my view of my own identity until much later, until very recently.
So just to interject, so, you know, you didn't, although you were born in China and your parents, did you have any siblings?
No. So I was born exactly in the time of the one child policy.
Interesting. So then you found yourself in these super white countries. And so it was easy to be called Lisa versus, you know, Jing.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, my dad was interesting. He's obviously, you know, a scientist, but he's also very creative. And he, you know, painted. He's a really amazing artist. And now that he's kind of retired, that's all he does is paint. And so when I was growing up, I kind of, you know, grew up with both sides, right? And I wanted to go to art school, but then they promptly shut that down. And so our compromise of not becoming a scientist or a doctor was to go to business school. So after all the moving, we eventually went to Canada, where it was just easier for my family to immigrate to at the time than to come to the US. And so I grew up mostly in Canada, and I think I was really happy that I did that because it was just such a diverse, you know.
It is. Were you in Toronto or were you?
Yeah, Toronto.
Yeah, I mean, it's very diverse, and there's a huge Asian population there as well.
Yeah, exactly. So I felt like, for the first time, I felt, you know, I actually feel a sense of belonging here, and it was a great place to kind of like spend my formative years. But that business school I went to, there was an exchange kind of program with Tsinghua University in Beijing. And so I, in my 20s, or I guess like, yeah, right, my last year of college, I went to Beijing, and that just blew my mind. This was right around the time of the Olympics. And so much was happening. They were like kind of opening up China, and like a lot of excitement in the air. And there was this like, you know, incredible place of history that was also like coexisting with all of this modernity. And so I just fell in love with Beijing and was like, I need to be here now. So
how long did you stay?
So I was there for about 8 months. I had already signed to work at P&G back in Canada. So I went back to do that. But I just kept thinking about China and the opportunities. And it just seemed like it was kind of endless opportunities, and I was doing things that I wouldn't have dreamed of. You know, there's just kind of a sense that you didn't have to ask for permission. You can just do whatever you want.
Yeah.
And so I realized, you know, I started my career at P&G. I'd worked there for many summers before I graduated, and then full time. And it just seemed like I knew exactly what that life was going to be. And for me, I just always wanted more. And so the first
entrepreneurial spirit, you know,
right.
I mean, every entrepreneur that I know who has been in those type of businesses got there, and within a very short time were like, oh my God, this is not going to be the rest of my life.
Right. Right. Yeah. So I moved to China shortly thereafter. Because I'm Canadian and all my friends at the time were like working for BlackBerry. So I got a job with BlackBerry.
And wow, that place, what a disaster that was.
Well, that's a whole other story. My team, which was on the software and services side, we were doing the things that would have kept the company alive had the hardware side listened to us.
Oh my God.
We were working on licensing the software basically across other platforms, right? Like if iPhones could use BBM, BlackBerry might be alive today.
You know what I mean? 100%.
So that was our project. And of course, you know, there was a lot of politics and, you know, old white men in Waterloo, Ontario, who had never left. So
I did decide that, like, okay, I want to bring some of my personal culture and in a product to life that is going to be what I want to do with my life.
Yeah, so that happened totally accidentally. So I was working in tech, but I was more interested in eating all of the food there was in China, right? Like the food is delicious. It's so nothing like I knew, because growing up, we lived in Germany, England, Austria, France, like places where there wasn't the ingredients. And so my mom had to adapt the cooking at home to whatever was available. So it was always a mishmash of like random things. And I didn't realize what I was missing, right? Like Chinese food culture is 5,000 years of heritage. It's so rich and complex, but none of that really translates to the West. And so I was just like exploring, I was eating, I was learning about the food culture, and I started a food blog. And it was really like talking about just my take on like the food culture in China, all the different regional specialties, and that kind of took off. And, you know, celebrity chefs, when they would come to China, they would, you know, seek me out to like take them around to eat. I was on like Andrew Zimmern's show, like Eddie Huang, and, you know, Emeril. So that kind of was my side thing. And that started taking off. And I realized, well, for me, I think I realized later that I was so into it really as a way to reconnect with who I was, right? Because I had been so disconnected from it.
Right.
And, you know, I remember filming a documentary with the BBC about Sichuan food, and I brought the camera crew and the host into my grandparents' kitchen. And, you know, at that point I had already been apart from my extended family for like 20 plus years. And, you know, my language ability wasn't great and we just weren't very close. And that experience, I remember bringing us closer, like just my grandmother, like teaching us how to make her homemade pickles and, you know, this kind of thing. And I realized it was a tool for me to kind of get to know who I was again. And so it was very,
you enjoyed.
Yeah. Plus it was delicious.
I'm into this. Like, this is a fun industry and I like the food, and where am I going to go with this thing?
Right. Yeah. So eventually I left BlackBerry. At this point, I had moved to Singapore and then moved back to China, and I was in Shanghai. And there I was working for Frog Design Company, innovation consultancy. And after a couple of years, I was like, I really want to do food full time. And I didn't know what exactly it was. I was writing a lot for publications, but I wanted to create something. And just ended up meeting a future business partner of mine, and we decided to open a restaurant. So that, I think when you say CPG companies are like one of the hardest companies to start.
Restaurants are even worse.
Restaurants are worse.
Totally. I mean, even up to this point, your career is ever winding. And I mean, I'm always a big believer that all the dots connect, but it's obvious, you know, from an outsider that you were just like, hey, not this, not this, not this.
Right. Not this, but also like this cool. But after a couple of years, I'm like, okay, what else is there to learn? Right. And so, and what can I do? Like, where can I learn these lessons so that I can then bring it together to start my own thing? And that's what I was always kind of thinking. So when I felt like the learning curve was slowing, that's when I would move on to the next thing. So yeah. And then, so the restaurant thing, I mean, that was probably the most challenging thing I've ever done. Well,
that's cool.
It's all really challenging, but, you know, starting a restaurant in China, you know, learning, navigating the landscape there, the rules and regulations, hiring, you know, I had to form a team of Chinese people I had to manage, and my language skills had to, you know, improve. I needed to navigate all of the kind of, in Chinese, it's called guanxi, right? Like the relationships. Because it's all about relationships to get anything done in China, right? And like the nuance of those relationships. And so we ended up opening.
It'd be very interesting. I mean, every city's different, every state is different. But I would think that over there, I mean, the rules and regulations are completely different.
Yeah, yeah. In some ways, it's actually super, super hard, and the rules are super strict and stringent, which is also why there's a lot of underground ways to do things as well. So you can do things the proper way, which might be much harder than anything in the West, but then, you know, there's all the other layers. So yeah, it was a tremendous learning kind of opportunity. We ended up opening about a year later, and this was a fast casual restaurant that I was inspired by Sweetgreen and Chipotle and these QSR models, but I wanted to feature regional Chinese flavors because I just thought there was so much to celebrate there and to really shine a light on that. And so we opened, and it was kind of the first such restaurant that was like modern design, you know, just, you know, like affordable but also sustainably sourced. And so it made a lot of waves.
Next generation.
Exactly, next gen. And I think, yeah, at the time it was like one of the first of its kind. And
what was the name?
Baoism. So we sold different forms of baos and bowls that you could customize. And and it was like super modern and really beautiful design. So
how long did that last?
So that lasted about 2 years. We did really well, won a bunch of awards, international, you know, acclaim and local, but it was, you know, I had a really, like, one of the crucial lessons I learned was that the importance of picking the right business partners. And at the time, you know, in my mid-20s, I was like, oh, you've got money? Great. Like, I've got the ideas and the hustle. Let's just come together and make this happen. But obviously, there's a lot more that you should look for in a partner than just that. So it ended up being, you know, he was like this young kid with a lot of family money and with a lot of ego as well, right? And so when we were doing things and things were taking off and I was getting a lot of the attention, or, you know, for having created the concept, he got jealous. And so it ended up in a really kind of bad situation. So I ended up leaving the business and it closed down not long after, unfortunately. But at the time, you know, it felt like a tremendous loss because I had spent, you know, 2-3 years of my life on this and it was such a big part of my identity, and to have that taken away from me, I felt, you know, like my whole world was like falling apart. But
by the way, I mean, every entrepreneur, particularly women, find that when a business dies, it's like, you know, mm-hmm. that was all about me. And it's really important to separate yourself from one.
Yeah. And I've learned that now with Fly By Jing. But at the time it was a shock. But I also, in kind of like true, like, you know, immigrant, like Asian immigrant fashion, I was like, okay, no time to process this trauma. Like, let me, you know, move on as quickly as possible. And so I kind of didn't address it. You know, I immediately was on to the next thing. And, you know, I moved to Chengdu. I was like, okay, what is my contribution to Chinese cuisine? And how do I move this forward? Because I'm not interested in just like doing something that's been done before, and just like how a chef, you know, expresses their own vision in a restaurant, or like an artist expresses, you know, it's like, what can I express that is a true reflection of who I am, my experiences, because that's the only thing I can do, right? And so, but for that, I needed to get down to the basics first. So I went to Chengdu. There was this master chef in Sichuan called Yu Bo, and I asked him if I could just stage in his kitchen, and I stayed with them for a summer, learned so much from him, like his, you know, cookbooks that are centuries, years old, and learn all about the importance of quality ingredients as well, like just the care that he takes in sourcing some of these ingredients that are so special and so rare that the normal person will never have access to it.
Right. They're part of your region.
Yeah. And they're like so specific and so, such, you know, so high in demand that they're not available, you know, even within China, not to mention anywhere outside of China. Right. But I could tell that, like, I mean, I really started to appreciate how important the quality of the ingredient is in the final product, because you can use the same recipe and different, you know, ingredients have completely different products. Mm-hmm. So that gave me a true appreciation of the provenance of ingredients. And I really, you know, got deep into that. And then I was inspired by this type of restaurant in Chengdu, which, you know, I was born in Chengdu, and the food that I ate, you know, when I was growing up were all in these kind of hole in the wall type places that were super popular because, like, no matter how dirty, how hidden, people find them because they're so delicious. They're called fly restaurants because people flock to them like flies. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like this Chengdu locals, like, cheeky way of referring to themselves as flies, because they're, you know, Sichuan is a province within China that's known for kind of its quality of life. It's really, I don't know if you've been to Sichuan.
I've been to Shanghai.
Oh, okay. So Shanghai is super fast, like big city. Sichuan is like almost a polar opposite. It's beautiful. It's surrounded by mountains. The climate is really wonderful. It's called the land of plenty because of the climate. There's so much produce and amazing, you know, things to eat. And people in Chengdu are all about quality of life. And that's like, you know, drinking tea in the park, playing mahjong, eating as a pastime, eating as a lifestyle. And so flavor above everything. And so I was just really inspired by these fly restaurants, which are basically the heart and soul of Sichuan's food culture. And I saw also the way that young, like the next generation of fly restaurants were evolving, because, you know, the older generation were like the mom and pop kind of doing things like their way. But then I saw these young kids opening new age fly restaurants and not being bound by any rules. And meanwhile, you know, I was noticing,
which we see in every urban city.
Right. But I was noticing in the West that when it comes to Chinese food, for example, there was kind of this like preoccupation with trying to keep it in a box, like, you know, keep it in a point in time and lock it up. And, you know, it can't evolve past that because then it's not authentic or then it's not traditional. And we only want that because that's kind of like
the Americanized version of what it's supposed to be.
Yeah. And also like, you know, less Americanized, but, you know, the Chinese, like the traditional Chinese, it's like, oh yeah, well, you know, I've been to this place in Flushing, so I know what Chinese food is like. And so it can't be anything other than that. Otherwise I will not accept it as authentic. So there was just kind of this like need.
So many areas. I mean, it's crazy. Yeah. But when did you decide that you were going to start making this chili?
Yeah, so I actually started by cooking. So I started an underground supper club that was, you know, what does modern Sichuan food mean? And so for me, that meant like rooted in tradition, but also informed by my experiences, having lived and cooked, you know, all over the world. And also in a way, in a format that's like made for the way we eat today. So I started this supper club that I took on the road. I cooked in places all over the world. And everywhere I went, people's like faces would light up with these flavors that they'd never had before, had never heard of before. And I realized that there was something there, right? Because there was basically no access to these ingredients, but the flavor was universal. So for a lot of my dishes, I actually had like sauce bases that I was preparing in large batches for these dinners. And I realized, oh, this is shelf stable. It's a chili oil or it's a spice powder. And I started to bottle it and started selling it in Shanghai at first. And then in 2018, I was traveling in the US. I was visiting some friends and went to Expo West, which is like the largest.
It's insane.
It's insane. And
you're ill by the time you leave. And you're just like, taste the weirdest shit.
Exactly. So I was, after 3 days of just tasting and tasting, I was like, wait, why am I like craving Asian food? Oh, it's because I didn't taste anything that had like those flavors. And I was just craving it. And I was like, that's weird. It's 2018. We're in America. Like, it's a very diverse country. And I knew just from industry reports that most of the growth that's coming from, you know, CPG, especially in the natural foods industry, is going to be coming from more diverse ethnic flavors.
No question, right? Because, you know, and as we have more groceries in different areas. I mean, you know, when I'm in New York and in LA, you know, I go to all the different neighborhoods and you go into the groceries, the bodegas, the products they're carrying there are completely different, you know, than your big Wegmans or what have you not. And I love buying all those products. I mean, I usually get very carried away.
Yeah.
But that is where all the growth is coming from. No question.
Right. And there was no representation at Expo West from the brands there. And also the people who were, you know, the buyers that were walking the halls were just like not really diverse at all. And so that's when I was like, okay, I think it's time. And I went back to Shanghai and I started a Kickstarter. That was to test it out.
It was really smart. I bought it, by the way. I bought your first round of Kickstarter. You know, and I was just like, oh, this sounds delicious. Because everyone needs a really good chili in their refrigerator for anything you make. I mean, I don't care what it can go on. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think I got a bunch of them and I've gone back and rebought.
Oh, wow. Thank you. Yeah. It was really crazy. The
packaging is really great too.
Thank you. Yeah. So with that packaging, it was really just to kind of stop people in their tracks and have them kind of question why they expected Chinese sauce to look differently, right? Because it was very different from anything that was existing on the market. But
it's very modern.
But I was like, why not? You know, I was inspired by a lot of beauty brands, actually. And I was just like, why not? Why not kind of create a new paradigm, right? Because Chinese food doesn't have to be cheap, dirty, unhealthy.
Nope.
And if we remove it from that context completely, where it reframes you, you know, completely, then maybe we can start over. So that's kind of how I approach the branding.
I mean, I will tell you, every year when I'm out in LA, I take one journey a season, and I go down to
San Gabriel.
San Gabriel Mountain. And we would go, I would figure out what are the 8 restaurants. And we'll go to each of them and have their only dish. It's supposedly their dish. But over the years that we have gone, what is interesting is they are mostly, you know, fly-by type restaurants. But now we're seeing a next generation of like cool looking restaurants that are serving different kinds of dishes that are a lot more modern takes on what they think is the next generation based on where their region they're cooking from, and delish.
Yeah.
You know, and because of COVID, we didn't do it this year or last year, but we decided next year we're going to only go to those more modern ones because the food to us was much more interesting and much more forward thinking.
Yeah. And I think it's great that like in New York and LA, you're seeing more of these restaurants come to life because it's almost like we're realizing that, you know, we don't need to ask for permission, right? It's like there is diversity. We're not just a monolith. Yeah. The fact that we're able to all exist is really great.
So you did the Kickstarter campaign, which was obviously a success, but what made you do Techstars?
Yeah, good question. I wouldn't recommend other CPG founders go that route, actually.
Was it just because of your tech background, it sort of felt comfortable with the food?
It felt comfortable because of my tech background. And I also, you know, I came to the US with no network in the US, right? Like I'm Canadian, I spent 10 plus years in Asia. I didn't know the first thing about raising money, about, you know, a startup and D2C and CPG. And I was listening to all these podcasts and reading all these books, like all the How I Built This and like trying to learn from as many voices as possible. Right. So I'm not repeating mistakes because, you know, my last business.
Right. So Techstars made sense. I mean, the best thing about Techstars, and I've said this to Brad Feld, which is, you know, it's like a Law and Order episode. It doesn't matter what the product is. There's this 3-month program and you can fit anything into it. The issue isn't about what you're learning, because I'm sure you learn plenty. Mm-hmm. It's about people that are coming to look at the entrepreneurs inside the program where it's located and putting capital and money behind the products. Are the companies. And, you know, as we all know, it's harder for women and it's even more harder for people that are building food companies because that's not who the investors are that go to Texas.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So in a way, like I learned, you know, that framework was great learning for me as a founder. It really did enable me to kind of think about things with scale, which at the, before that point, I was the only person working on this and, you know, I was doing everything. And so that allowed me to kind of take a step back to your point earlier, like separating yourself from the business to be able to better serve the business as well. And, you know, but when you look at the other benefits, like some of my other, you know, fellow founders had, which were investors that actually invested in their companies, you know, and that network that helps their businesses, it didn't help me, right? So yeah, but so I wouldn't recommend most CPG founders go that route, but I felt like it gave me a good kind of foundation to, but
and I'm really glad for business.
Truly, yeah. And I'm really glad that none of the investors invested in me then.
You figured it out, right? I mean, the CPG companies that I have invested in And I'll see a lot of women. I mean, they take money once or twice and they're so scarred by the experience. And if you have something, particularly what you have, which is completely a unique product with a completely unique flavor profile, if you can figure out how to make money or take some kind of loan that doesn't have, you know, ridiculous covenants, you know, you can just continue growing.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really important for me to maintain profitability from day one. So I bootstrapped. Kickstarter was, you know, a way to, for us to do our first batch. But since then, you know, it was bootstrapped. I took a few angel checks here and there, very small amounts, and, you know, used things like Shopify capital and, you know, ClearBank.
Great. Yeah. You know, who else has great capital is Flexport.
Flexport. Okay.
Flexport has great capital.
Okay, good to know. Yeah, so, and you know, making sure that we never really, we always grew organically, right? Through word of mouth, through media and free media as well. So, you know, we were never kind of like pumping money into ads and stuff like that. So I think that got us pretty far. And, you know, we were growing at a pretty steady rate. And then, you know, last year during the lockdown, we really started to accelerate our growth. So.
You know, what's interesting about that, and how many people are working for you now?
We are almost 10, but we're about 7 right now.
Wow. Okay. But all the companies that I have been involved with who have really great products in the CPG space or even the consumer product space, if they're good, they exploded during COVID.
Right.
And if they weren't, they died. Mm-hmm. And I think the one thing that COVID did was it accelerated great companies quickly, and particularly in food, because what do? We're sitting inside, you know, by ourselves,
yeah,
cooking meals 3 times a day.
Yeah.
So it was a good year for you.
Yes. Yes. We were up 1,000% from our first year.
That's unbelievable. And you have now 3 products, right?
So we have 3 core products. We also have like kind of a suite of like super high quality pantry products. So probably about 10 plus products in total. And then we've got merch and, you know, we've got this great community around our brand now. So people are like, you know, I see people on the street who I don't know wearing our merch, which is really insane.
Really amazing. And also, you know, the one thing I've learned about product is you need products that turn quickly in someone's house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, certain products you don't need every week or two.
Right.
You need to keep, you know, 6 months and you still haven't finished them.
Right. So we've been really focused on increasing use cases, right? So we're very, like, since day one, we've been like, there's no rules to using this product. You don't have to just use it when you're making mapo tofu. You can make this, you can put this on anything you're already eating. So allow it to just kind of blend into your life as you are. So whether it's eggs in the morning, your pizza, your takeout, and you don't have to cook at all, ice cream, like, so the more uses, the better. And so I think, you know, we've been really driving that up. And now we have this like large big boy size, which is almost 3 times the size of the regular. And people are flying through those as well.
I'm sure they are. I'm going to have to get one of those. That's fantastic. So, you know, I'm curious. I mean, so now full circle, you know, you've gone back to your name that you were, you know, given and sort of returned to the roots that you pushed down for so many years because you were in areas where you didn't feel like you belonged. Mm-hmm. Which is amazing to come full circle and then be able to create something that other people love and create a business around it. You know, what are your thoughts about what happened in Atlanta? And you know, it's just another thing that has sort of come out of this COVID, which is all the nasty little, you know, dust bunnies underneath the carpet have figured a way to finally crawl out over the past, you know, 13, 14 months. You know, I'm Jewish, you know, anytime we see something anti-Semitic, I freaking freak, right? You know, and to see what's going on, I mean, you know, even with this trial that's happening in Detroit is pretty, pretty crazy.
Yeah.
Have you talked about how you feel about that?
Yeah. So we have, like, we've talked about it on our socials. We talk to our Asian, especially female kind of community, you know, in a way that's kind of holding them with care and, with no, you know, I think at times like this, it's the temptation to kind of jump to express or shout about, you know, whatever that's going on right now. And for us, like, we want to honor everybody's, like, different kind of ways of processing. And, you know, but as a company, we're really lucky to have this platform to be able to, you know, give back. And so, you know, 10% of all of our proceeds this month are going towards organizations helping the Asian community. And, you know, I think this type of aversion towards Asian people and culture is not new, right? It's been happening for centuries. You know, the Chinese were the first ethnic group that were singled out to be banned from entering the U.S., right, in the Chinese Exclusion Act. And the whole reason why, you know, Chinese food even took off in this country was a byproduct of some of these laws that did not allow Chinese people to live in this country except through very specific loopholes, one of which included restaurants. So that's the whole reason. That's the whole reason that Chinese restaurants exploded, but also the reason why it evolved in the way it did into Chinese American food, because most of these people who were starting these restaurants didn't come from a restaurant background or food background. They just needed to survive. So it's a story of survival. So of course the cuisine evolved with that. You know, if you look at the number of Chinese restaurants in America, there's over 50,000. It is more than all the McDonald's, Taco Bell's, and, you know, Subway's put together, right? So in some ways, Chinese food is the most popular cuisine in America. And maybe, yeah. And I bet a lot of these people who, you know, have these anti-Asian sentiments enjoy their Asian food, right? But, you know, I think that America's, like, love for, you know, Chinese cuisine and all kinds of cuisine, there is, you know, since we launched, for example, there's been a lot of people who, you know, trolls on the internet or just people who, like, try to compare us to La Gamma, for example, which is, like, the old school brand from China, the only brand that's really has a presence in America. And that's because it's the only brand that they have had experience with, right? So when you have had an experience with Chinese food in some way, there's kind of a feeling of, like, sometimes ownership or entitlement, like, okay, I know Chinese food, it's like this, you know, and it doesn't allow for the cuisine or the culture or its people to evolve, right? And that's what I was so inspired by with the Fly restaurants in China. The young people were just pushing it forward and, like, where can we go with this? Because as we all know, if a cuisine or a culture doesn't evolve, it dies. And so that was a big MO for us as Fly by Jing, is we have this platform and we really want to evolve and, you know, allow for more diverse voices to exist. So I think in a way, just the fact of us existing is a form of resistance, right? It is, and in the approach that we have as well, when we first launched, I was still Jenny and the brand was still quite defensive and almost like, you know, I felt like I was constantly fighting for my right to exist, to be here. You know, investors would tell me there's no opportunity for Chinese food. Like, this is never going to go anywhere. I know. Literally Techstars investors told me this is too niche. Chinese food is too niche.
That's hilarious.
Right. And, like, I was constantly kind of defending myself. And so as we evolved, And by the way, like, we grew, you know, 1,000% last year over the year before at the height of, you know, kind of anti-Asian sentiment, right? So the product speaks for itself, right? And then, you know, this year we're looking at, you know, 5x our growth. Mm-hmm. So, you know, at a certain point, we also rebranded to a much more unapologetic tone as well. So our new tagline is not traditional, but personal. And that is to really drive the point home that this is not your product, like, to claim, you know, this is my personal expression. I made it for myself, but you can have some too.
Right. This is not your grandma's product.
Right. Exactly. That is our way of saying we are not a monolith and there's diversity, nuance, and complexity to all of our different voices and they all deserve to exist. And, you know, as part of that, I also found my own inner strength to, like, reclaim my own personal name. So I think if you look at our brand today, it's a different vibe from the brand that launched on Kickstarter. You know, and since we launched, we were one of the first Asian food brands to launch in America. And now there's many, and all of them are founders who I know personally because they've contacted me to tell me that they were inspired by Fly By Jing.
That's fantastic.
So we're really here to create space for more voices like ours to exist. And I think that in itself is the work that we're doing to combat this.
Yeah, it's the future. Well, thank you so much for sharing that. I mean, just a great story. I mean, truly. And your products are fantastic.
Thank you so much.
They really are. And good luck in your new digs there.
Thank you so much.
All right, take care. All right, bye.
Bye.
To learn more about Fly By Jing, you can visit her website at flybyjing.com. Our next guests on PGG will be Alexandra Fennell and Mia Bruzis, the CEO of the new direct-to-consumer company, Attention Grace, which focuses on intimate products for aging women.